Next, we must ask ourselves how the other element, which until now we have characterized merely as the object of observation, enters consciousness, where it encounters thinking. To answer this question, we must purge our field of observation of everything that thinking has already brought into it. For the content of our consciousness at any moment is always already permeated by concepts in the most varied way. We must imagine that a being with a fully developed human intelligence arises from nothing and confronts the world. What this being would be aware of before it brought thinking into action is the pure content of observation. The world would then reveal to this being only the pure relationless aggregate of sensory objects, colors, sounds, sensations of pressure, warmth, taste, and smell, and then feelings of pleasure and unpleasure. This aggregate is the content of pure, thought-free observation. Over against it stands thinking, which is ready to unfurl its activity when a point of departure is found. Experience soon teaches that it is found. Thinking is able to draw threads from one element of observation to another. It joins specific concepts to these elements, and thus brings them into a relationship with each other. We have already seen how a noise we encounter is linked with another observation, in that we characterize the former as the effect of the latter. If we recall that the activity of thinking should never be considered subjective, we will not be tempted to believe that such relationships, which are established by thinking, have merely a subjective validity. It now becomes a question of discovering through thinking contemplation how the immediately given content of observation, the pure relationless aggregate of sensory objects, relates to our conscious subject. Because of shifting habits of speech, it seems necessary for me to come to an agreement with my reader on the use of a word that I must employ from now on. The word is percept. I will use the word percept to refer to the immediate objects of sensation mentioned above, insofar as the conscious subject knows these objects through observation. Thus, it is not the process of observation, but the object of observation that I designate with this name. I have not chosen to use the term sensation, because sensation has a specific meaning in physiology that is narrower than that of my concept of the percept. I can easily characterize a feeling within myself as a percept, but not as a sensation in the physiological sense. By its becoming percept for me, I gain knowledge even of my feeling. And because we gain knowledge of our thinking too, through observation, we can even call thinking, as it first appears to our consciousness, a percept. The naive person considers percepts as they first appear to be things that have an existence quite independent of the human being in question. If we see a tree, we initially believe that the tree, in the form that we see it, with its various colors, etc., is standing there in the spot to which our gaze is directed. From this naive standpoint, if we see the sun appear in the morning as a disk on the horizon and then follow the progress of this disk, we believe that all of this exists and occurs just as we observe it. We cling fast to this belief until we meet other percepts that contradict the first. The child, with no experience of distances, reaches for the moon, and only when a second percept comes to contradict the first can the child correct what at first seemed real to it. Every extension in the sphere of my percepts makes me correct my image of the world. This is evident in daily life just as it is in the spiritual evolution of humankind. The ancient image of the relation of the earth to the sun and the other heavenly bodies had to be replaced by that of Copernicus, because the ancient image did not agree with new, previously unknown percepts. When Dr. Franz operated on someone born blind, the latter said that before his operation he had arrived, through the sense of touch, at a very different image of the size of objects. He had to correct his tactile percepts with his visual percepts. Why are we compelled continually to correct our observations? A simple reflection provides the answer to this question. If I stand at the end of an avenue, The trees at the other end appear to me smaller and closer together than those where I am standing. My perceptual picture changes as I change the place from which I make my observations. Thus the form in which the perceptual image confronts me depends on conditions determined not by the object, but by me, the perceiver. The avenue does not care where I stand, but the image that I have of the avenue is fundamentally dependent on where I stand. In the same way, it makes no difference to the sun and the solar system that human beings regard them just from the earth. But the perceptual image of the heavens that presents itself to human beings is determined by their living on the earth. This dependence on the perceptual image, on our place of observation, is the easiest kind of dependence to understand. The issue becomes more difficult when we realize the dependence of our perceptual world on our bodily and spiritual organization. The physicist shows that vibrations of the air are present in the space where we hear a sound, and that even the body in which we seek the source of the sound displays a vibrating movement in its parts. But we become aware of this movement as sound only if we have a normally constructed ear. Without this, the whole world would be forever silent for us. Physiology teaches us that there are some people who perceive nothing of the magnificent splendor of color surrounding us. Their perceptual picture shows only nuances of dark and light. Others fail to perceive only a specific color, such as red. Their image of the world lacks this hue, and is therefore actually different from that of the average human being. I should like to call the dependence of my perceptual image on my place of observation a quote-unquote mathematical one, and its dependence on my organization a quote qualitative one. The relative sizes and distances of my percepts are determined through the former, the mathematical relationship, their quality through the latter, qualitative. That I see a red surface as red, this qualitative determination depends on the organization of my eye, EYE. Initially, then, our perceptual images are subjective. This recognition of the subjective character of our percepts can easily lead us to doubt whether anything objective underlies them at all. If we know that a percept, for example, the color red or a particular sound, is only possible thanks to the structure of our organism, then we can easily come to believe that the percept does not exist outside our subjectivity, and that apart from the act of perceiving, whose object it is, it has no kind of existence. This view found its classic expression in George Berkeley, who believed that as soon as we become aware of the importance of the subject for percepts, we can no longer believe in a world that exists apart from the conscious spirit. Quote, "Some truths are so near and so obvious to the mind that man need only open his eyes to see them. Such I take this important truth to be, to wit, that all the choir of heaven and furniture of the earth, in a word, all those bodies which compose the mighty frame of the world, have not any subsistence without a mind, that their being is to be perceived or known, that consequently, so long as they are not actually perceived by me, or do not exist in my mind, or that of any other created spirit, they must either have no existence at all, or else subsist in the mind of some eternal spirit." End quote. From this point of view, nothing remains of the percept if we exclude the process of its being perceived. There is no color when none is seen, no sound when none is heard. Outside the act of perception, categories such as extension, form, and movement exist just as little as color and sound. Nowhere do we see extension or form alone. Rather, we always see these in conjunction with color or other qualities indisputably dependent on our subjectivity. If the latter disappear from our perception, then so must the former, which are bound to them. To the objection that even if figure, color, sound, and so forth do not exist outside the act of perception, there must still be things that exist without consciousness and are similar to the conscious perceptual images, the Berkeleyan response would be to say that a color can only be similar to a color, a figure similar to a figure. Our percepts can be similar only to our percepts, not to any other kind of thing. Even what we call an object is nothing but then a group of percepts connected in a certain way. But if I take away from a table its form, extension, color, and so forth, in fact, everything that is only my percept, then nothing more is left. This view, followed through logically, thus leads to the assertion that the objects of my perception are only present through me. They disappear with my perceiving, and have no meaning without it. Apart from my percepts, I know of no objects and can know of none. There is nothing to object to in this claim, as long as it remains merely a general consideration of how the percept is partly determined by the organization of the subject. The matter would appear fundamentally different, however, if we were in a position to describe the exact function of our perceiving in the origin of a percept. We would then know what happens to the percept during perceiving, and could also determine what aspect of the percept must already exist before it is perceived. With this, our investigation is directed away from the object of perception and toward its subject. I do not perceive only other things, I also perceive myself. In contrast to the perceptual images that continually come and go, I am what remains. This initially is the content of my percept of myself. When I have other percepts, the percept of the I, capital, can only always appear in my consciousness. However, when I am immersed in the perception of a given object, then for the time being I am conscious only of the latter. The percept of myself can be added to this. I am then not merely conscious of the object, but also of my personality, which stands over against the object and observes it. I not only see a tree, I also know that I am the one who sees it. Moreover, I realize that something goes on in me while I observe the tree. If the tree disappears from my view, a remnant of this process remains in my consciousness, an image of the tree. As I was observing, this image united itself with myself. Myself is thereby enriched. Its content has received a new element into itself. I call this element my mental picture, Vorstellung, of the tree. There would be no need to speak of mental pictures if I did not experience them in the percept of myself. In that case, percepts would come and go. I would let them pass by. It is only because I perceive myself and notice that with every percept the content of myself also changes that I find myself compelled to connect the observation of the object with my own changed state and to speak of my mental picture.